You're listening to Campus Review Radio.
Welcome to HeadX, hosted by Martin Betts. This podcast explores the changing landscape of the higher education sector. Welcome to the Higher Education Experience.
Well, welcome to the HeadX podcast, and regular listeners will be a bit surprised that it is not Martin Betts conducting the interview, but in fact, on this occasion, Martin is the subject of the interview. So, Emeritus Professor Martin Betts, welcome to your own podcast. Welcome to HeadX.
Thanks very much, Ant. It's always delightful to be here, and it's particularly delightful for me to be here in this way at this particular time.
And Martin, we've known each other for a couple of years now, and you're a generous man. And I know you're generous in a lot of different ways. And one of those ways is providing a platform to others, providing a platform to explore ideas of higher education and this idea of changing higher education for good, which is your mantra, something that we'll come back to. The reason we're having this conversation and failing to introduce myself, I'm Ant Bagshaw, and I'm basically the bit part player in this, because this is an interview and this is a story about Martin. And you spend a lot of time being generous for other people, but you don't spend as much time on yourself. And for this 100th episode of the podcast, I and others wanted to make sure that we told your story. Is there anything you want to say in response to that?
I had to be persuaded by you and others to do this, and as you well know, it's not natural for me to want to talk about myself. There'll be some out there that will listen to this and say, oh yeah, you could fool me. But it's the values that I was born with are such that telling other people's stories and telling stories about situations that you've been part of rather than about yourself has always been the way that I've wanted to live my life, and was part of why I got involved in higher education and got involved with HeadX. And it's values that you, as with all values, you inherit from your family, I think, and from your background and from your growing up and from the heroes you have in your life.
So I'd love to start there, Martin. And first off, I want to acknowledge that this is a difficult time for you and the family. And you recently lost your father, Peter. And I want to say how very sorry I am to hear that news. And I'd like to start by giving you an opportunity to talk about your dad's and about your mum too, and to tell us a little bit about where you came from.
Yeah, well, look, last thing I'd want to do is to turn the HeadX podcast into the Betts family show or a sad forum, because it is a sad and reflective time for me. My dad, Peter, passed a week ago today. We're recording this on a Thursday. This episode will go out next Wednesday, 2 days after his funeral. I'll be reading a eulogy for him that he wrote about himself. Incredible man. When we're in the crematorium at Colchester in Essex next Monday. But my dad was my hero, is my hero. My mum is my hero too. And they grew up and I grew up in Essex. They were actually come from a seafaring town called Harwich on the coast of Essex, where the ferries go to Holland. I spent my first 6 months living there, but I was born in an ambulance travelling between Harwich and Colchester, which was my home, where I'm talking to you from now. I was in such a rush to get out, they said, that they needed to move me to Colchester to a bigger hospital, a bigger venue. But my parents were both hugely influential in me and my sister's life. I'll come back to my sister later. In showing us the value of hard work, healthy living, respect for others, not talking yourself up, but talking other people up, and being prepared to embrace adventure and change. I couldn't have hoped for a better start in life. And it's why that what might be a sad time for many people, it is sad for us all, but next Monday will be a celebration of my dad's 91 and a half years, for goodness sake. If I can achieve half of what he achieved in his life in the remaining years that I have on this earth, I'll be very, very pleased.
So that's a beautiful, beautiful sentiment, Martin, and wishing you and the family, giving Peter the send-off he deserved. I heard that when you were little, you didn't know that there was any other job other than being a fireman. That's what I heard. And I wonder, how did you fall so far from the truth?
Yeah, well, I think that that adventure that I talked about in my dad and my mum was probably something that amongst the I grew up on a fire station. I was born into a house around Harwich Fire Station, and 6 months later, I moved to what I thought was the only other place on earth, which was Colchester Fire Station. And all of my friends were sons and daughters of other firemen or other fire women control officers at the time. There weren't women firefighters, and we might come back to that later at the time. So, you know, all of my mates at primary school were fellow firefighter families, and we did everything as a community together. You know, you hear great stories of, and I don't want to compare and compete, but you hear great stories of coal mining families from Yorkshire or South Wales and from communities around other occupations that were the lives. That was my life growing up around a fire station in Colchester. And yes, I don't, there are three of my five best mates from our road who went on to be firemen. I didn't know what a university professor was until 18.
How did you make that leap? Because it is it is difficult, as we know, you know, and the data would bear this out, to be first in family and to go and pursue a higher education, not just to get an undergraduate, but then to go on to get your PhD and to go into academia. How did that work, and was there any tension with the family?
Tension in the family and in that community, to be honest. I grew up at a time when Essex was one of the last English counties to do away with the 11 plus, if I can talk about prehistoric concepts, and grammar schools. And my local primary school, there were three of us out of a class of, you know, several hundred that passed the 11 plus. And ended up going to the co-ed grammar school on the hill rather than St. Helena Secondary Modern near where our houses were. I was lucky enough to, you know, peak at the age of 11 when other people peak at different times. To this day, I will always, you know, lament the fact that my sister Jackie, who didn't peak at 11, was then channeled into secondary modern, channeled into non-higher education streams, channeled into a different life. She was channeled into such a stream, of course, being born female rather than male in those days. But all my male mates were similarly. I felt as though I'd failed when I failed to become a fireman and failed to go to St. Helena Secondary Modern, because all of the values were in staying in that community. But I broke out of it in a way that has been very lucky for me. But I recognize at a time like this the value of all things that we might do in life, and particularly being part of strong communities and doing that.
It's so interesting to pinpoint that one point, that one examination, as being the fork in the road for the paths that you might have taken. And I don't doubt that we would never have met had you been a fireman in Essex rather than a university professor. And I'm grateful, selfishly, that path was opened up to you. Harwich to Colchester is not a long distance. Colchester to London is not a long distance. The UK to Singapore is an enormous distance. How did you make that leap?
Well, I can remember Colchester to Harwich seeming like an awfully long way away, and a night spent on the drafty platform and the wind coming in off the North Sea on Manningtree Station, where you change trains, of bring back all sorts of horrors to me. I can remember going up to London a few times and thinking, is there life beyond London? So there's many in London that doubt it even still. But I mean, I did. I went away to university in Reading. I pursued PhD study. People that have been around for a while and knew the UK then, the Inner London Education Authority of the Greater London Council, there's a couple of dinosaurs that I was very fond of at the time. The Inner London Education Authority had a research assistance scheme, gave out PhD scholarships to people. I went to the hugely prestigious and institution of which I'm incredibly proud, called the Brixton School of Building, to do a PhD. It was one of the first PhDs from a long-standing trade and vocational institution. It went on to become a polytechnic. It went on to become a university. And as well as doing a PhD study questioning the relevance of data to construction managers and using tech to provide better solutions to them, I I was required to do up to six hours a week of teaching. That I included me teaching HNC students of building who were site managers in London. As a 23-year-old, I was teaching them about site management, which to this day just seems ludicrous and was very humorous to them at the time, I can assure you.
What was it about construction that got the academic juices flowing?
Done practically nothing in construction since. Will reveal to you and anyone interested that it's not so much construction. This is an awful story and I feel embarrassed about it, but somewhat proud of it too. That my school had a careers evening. There was the employers offering advice were arranged three sides of a square hall with desks with lines of queues of enthusiastic future learners in front of them. There were accountants, there were lawyers, there were the creative arts, there were engineers. And there was a construction, there was a quantity surveyor, construction manager, sat at a desk with no one in front of him. And I was keen to get out of there, so I went and talked to him. He offered me a summer job, and I ended up studying that subject. It's I worked in it for 6 weeks at the end of my first year and got so bored of it that I knew I wanted to get out of it. So researching it further and teaching some of the advances to be made in a very elementary profession, subject to slow change, became something that intrigued me. And I think some of those lessons still very much apply to me now in the way that I view higher education, I have to say.
Well, I'm not going to let you meander this conversation towards your current topic without coming back to my question on Singapore, because you spent a good few years at the National University of Singapore. How did you find that? Was it a culture shock?
Yeah, well, I should answer your question about how did I get to Singapore to start with. I finished my PhD in Yorkshire, a place that you know well, Ant, although it was the glorious West Riding rather than the part of the county that you come from. I was in Leeds and got my PhD and applied for three postdoctoral lecturing jobs, got interviewed in Liverpool, Salford, and for a job in NUS. They didn't fly me out to Singapore for the NUS job. They had an external examiner from Nottingham, and I travelled down on the train and went to and had an interview in his kitchen for this retired external examiner. I had a big strategic decision to make about that interview, and that was whether to take my earring out or not before I presented myself to a very conservative person that might have influence on me. I took it out, and I think I wouldn't have got the job if I hadn't have taken my earring out.
Was it more than a stud? Was it this some statement piece?
I did have a very different hairstyle then, I can assure you. But no, it was.
You had a hairstyle. I think would be a change from the current.
There was talk that I looked like David Cassidy at the time, but we'll let that one go. Probably because most people don't know who David Cassidy is, I dare say. But no,
they can Google him. Don't worry about it.
The earring was a simple stud. There was nothing elaborate about it. But in 1987, I don't think young construction management academics wore earrings very much. So I took it out and got the job.
And what was it like when you got that? Was it what you expected?
I was very much accepted. I can remember the earring came back as part of the story, because the Chinese Singaporean head of school, in introducing all new staff to all of the new students, would delight in telling them all the earring went back in once I'd got the job. But Singapore was a very different experience. You know, this is construction courses, and globally, the issue of gender equity remains hugely challenging for engineering, for STEM, and for construction courses. I turned up to a situation where every student was Singaporean, but because of the practice in NUS and in the Singapore system at the time of not inviting students to choose their subject, but allocating them to them, 80% of my students were young Singaporean female students, which was a big dramatic exposure to gender equity because their motivation for study was extremely challenged. And I was teaching big classes of 600 construction students, 80% female, along with some Master of Project Management students. I was only 28 at the time, freshly with a PhD and no knowledge of construction. And I was teaching project management to people that had built the Marina Mandarin, Raffles City in Singapore, people that were in charge of the what's widely regarded as being the most successful public housing scheme in the world. And there I was with my new PhD trying to teach these people how to manage projects. It was like Brixton School of Building and London site managers all over again.
What did you learn from that experience? What is it that you took from that you then that you can see still manifesting in your practice today?
Well, I took a lot of confidence that, I mean, the, you know, I could have gone to Liverpool or to Salford, or stayed in Yorkshire and stayed in the comfort zone that wasn't a comfort zone when I first encountered it, but became comfortable. Or I could take on changes of context and culture. I mean, I haven't mentioned the fact that going from teaching West Yorkshire site managers and UK students, even if they're traveling across cities, is a bit different from teaching largely Chinese, Malay, Indian, Singaporean ethnic students. I had very little understanding of their culture. I learned a lot about their culture. I learned a thirst for embracing equity and seeking to change it for the better, and a thirst for new cultures and how to work with them. And learned that different parts of the world can teach you things that you can't learn where you've come from yourself, and should be embraced at any opportunity.
And so from warm and sticky and diverse Singapore, you went to the glamorous location that is Salford, famous, interestingly, amongst UK institutions for being one of a small number of institutions with its own train station. But beyond that, I think at the time you were there, perhaps not known for much else.
Yeah, I knew about the Salford's train presence long ago from Henry Blofeld, and his cricket commentaries used to talk about the Salford Flyer that went behind Old Trafford Cricket Ground in between overs, for any cricket enthusiast that can remember that. But look, I didn't want to go back to the UK. I had very little inclination to go to Salford. I wanted to come to Australia in 1993 when I left Singapore and was actively exploring some options. But another external examiner twisted my arm, you know, offered me some opportunities that I couldn't refuse, with a family back in England, with two young children, two young daughters born in Singapore at NUS Hospital. Off we trotted back to the UK again for 10 years for jobs that I really, I mean, Salford has an image problem that you've already illustrated in your White Rose Way. But Salford University, when I went to it in 1993, was the UK's leading built environment school. Apologies for everybody from Loughborough and Reading out there, but it's true. And it got top rated in research assessment exercises three rounds running. And it was particularly focused on industry connections. It had had a big disruption when John Ashworth, its vice chancellor, suffered the Sir Keith Joseph and Margaret Thatcher 30% revenue cuts in overnight. Before I got there, and developed an enterprising university culture of an extraordinary proportion, combined with the best built environment school in the UK, and dare I say in Europe of its time, was too big a draw for me, despite the reputational challenges that Salford might have had. And I loved my time at Salford. I became a head of school there. I developed an industry centre of excellence that ended up being entrusted by the Minister for construction of the UK to be responsible for the national construction IT strategy. It was a great experience.
And I will, for the record, say that Salford University is doing exceptionally well these days, and has really, I think, been part of a turnaround in the reputation of that part of Greater Manchester, and certainly the institution is really going places. And I sound like I'm sponsored by Salford, but I've actually been there a number of times, and I'm actually really impressed with how what's been done in an area which has otherwise obviously experienced a lot of challenge sort of economically and socially.
Yeah, I concur with that. And I obviously have got a bit more of a stake in it, having worked there for 10 years. But my last act at Salford was to hold a national conference on construction education at the newly opened at the time Lowry Centre in the old Salford Quays. This is the home of the global industrial revolution that became the new home for the BBC and a media centre there. And there's a fantastic gallery in the name of L.S. Lowry, a brilliant Salford, I say Salford, not Manchester, Salford artist. And that was the peak for me, to be able to be part of a reborn Salford, setting a new agenda for education globally for construction departments in universities about the need for change.
And so we've been to Singapore, 10 years back in the UK, doing that pioneering work at Salford. And then Australia comes into play, and And you come to QUT first, and then you went on to Griffiths. So this is obviously, there's a Queensland piece here, and see, Australia is a fabulous place to live and to work. But you also made a transition into more senior leadership roles within the university, first as executive dean and then as the deputy vice chancellor. Can you tell us a little bit about that transition from your academic practice into more senior leadership roles?
Yeah, well, that actually started in Salford, Ant. I was the new professor running a research centre, the person demanding all the resources, all the space, making little contributions to the rest of the academic enterprise, the head of school's nightmare, probably. And watched other people trying to be head of school and thought, well, I can do this much better than you, to the point where they gave me the chance. And then it was the most challenging thing that I ever experienced. And the pressure of suddenly not just running my own research centre and master's programme, but looking after the needs of an academic staff complement at 60 was a huge challenge. I took on a leadership coach for the first time, a really good friend of mine who'd been working in HR in pharmaceuticals for many years. And I tried to embrace the challenges of academic leadership to the point where I really enjoyed it. Again, a new experience is when I mastered. I'd been brought back to Salford by someone who had been the head of school before the ones that I was criticising. He went on to be Deputy Vice Chancellor of Research at Salford University. But then in a bizarre way that UK universities, I don't know if they still widely practice it, but it's almost like being chief monk in the monastery, having your go at doing the admin for a few years. He was DVC Research, didn't get the VC's job, and so he was dropped back into my school for me to manage as my former mentor with all of his needs and expectations. And that was just too much for me. And I was facing the prospect of having been everyone else's head of school for 4 years, then dropping back in to be subject to whatever reprisals might have been caused by the challenges of leadership. And I thought, I want to be in a different place where academic leadership is treated differently. And Australian universities have always treated the career path of academic leadership in a different way, in a more advanced way, I would say, than UK universities. And therefore, I applied for 3 dean's jobs. They came up in the Guardian all at the same time. I applied for the executive dean job in my discipline area of built environment and engineering at all of RMIT, University of New South Wales and QUT simultaneously. The RMIT one fell over. There was a notorious IT problem in RMIT some 25 years ago that some listeners might recall. I actually got offered both the University of New South Wales and the QUT jobs simultaneously, and I chose QUT. I chose QUT because of its values, because of its industry positioning, and because I liked... Sorry, Ant, you're in New South Wales, aren't you?
I'm choosing not to take it personally, but that's okay. You seem to have had enormous success first at QUT and then at Griffith, and where you ended up as the Deputy Vice Chancellor Engagement at Griffith, and it's obviously where you're now an emeritus professor. Can we move on a little bit to talk about HEDX? And that's obviously the context that you and I have met, and I think it's the context where most of the listeners will know you from this project, the podcast, the events, the publications, all of the activity that you're doing to change higher education for good. You've had a successful career. You could have been a superannuated emeritus professor. You could have hung out on the beach in Sunshine Coast. And yet you've chosen to do something riskier, more entrepreneurial. Why?
Because of purpose, Ant. I came towards the end of my time at Griffith, was approaching 60. I can still remember the firemen's families in Colchester and Harwich was still asking me every time I came home what I was going to do when I left school. And 38 years of being favoured from being someone from a class other than went to university, to be favoured to an extent to be having such advantage in life was great. It set me up. It gave me experiences. It allowed my family, my children, and my mum and dad and others to to really have advantage that wouldn't have occurred if I hadn't have been in the right place at the right time with 11 pluses in Essex at the age of 11. Shortly before I left Griffith, about the most important thing in my life then happened, which is my sister, my older sister, Jackie, 2 years older than me. She passed. She had an aneurysm at the age of 56. And I reflected on what opportunities she had had in life compared with mine as someone that, because of her gender and because of a selective education system at a single point in time, didn't have all the opportunities that I had. And I thought to myself that in her honor, I don't want to just duck out with a very nice uni super support and rest. I want to do something in my sister's name and now, dare I say, in my dad's name. At my sister's funeral, my sister was one of the first gay marriages in Essex. And at her funeral, me and my dad wore pink shirts, and a lot of the mourners wore rainbow feather boas as a demonstration of pride. I was very proud of them. And in my conversations towards the end of my time at Griffith, I used this line of feeling like a pink shirt amongst the brown cardigans of a university chancellery. And I'd sort of succumbed to that for 38 years, but that's not my values. That's not what I believe in. And I wore pink shirts in just about every day in honor of Jackie in my last days at Griffith University. I'll wear my dad's pink tie at his funeral next Monday. But what I resolved to do in leaving Griffith was, I'm not going to rest. I'm going to try and bring about change for gender, for class, for purpose in higher education to the best of my ability in this next phase of my career. I'm going to learn as a lifelong learner how to embrace that. I'm going to seek to tell stories, and I'm going to seek to work with others in bringing about change. And that's what I embarked upon in August 2020 with Headaches, with my initial partner of Carl Treacher, who was very instrumental in helping me so greatly in getting Headaches underway.
Martin, thank you. Thank you for... I said earlier that you're a generous man, and I think you've been generous in sharing that story. I've heard you talk about being a pink shirt in the past, and I've understood that. I've understood what you meant, but when we've spoken previously, you haven't situated it in the broader story. And I'm really delighted that we can honour Jackie's memory in this conversation. And I can't imagine that she wouldn't be proud of you and everything that you've achieved. And I'm sure Peter will be proud.
Yeah, I'm proud of them. I'm proud of everything that they stand for and everything that they did in their lives. And I'm going to do everything I can in the rest of my life to try and honour their values in bringing... There's been a lovely piece published today. This is the Thursday before the podcast is going out in the Happy blog this morning. I know you're a fan of a lot of these sources of information, and you may have seen it, you may not have done it. It's addressing the issue of the remaining and deepening class divide in global universities. We have lots of work going on in diversity, equity, and inclusion that I celebrate. It's addressing issues of race and gender and sexual preference, but there's not enough happening. And I think the accord that we're seeing in Australia at the moment, the very troubling debate that's happening in the UK and the US at the moment around access and purpose in global universities, I think the issue of class, and you and I come from a UK system where class is so strong, it might be played out with different terms and in different ways in other parts of the world. I think it's bad that a fireman's son from Essex, or a working class child or lifelong learner from anywhere in the world, or a Starbucks worker in Arizona, or a Bunnings worker in Australia, dare I say, has different chances of embracing higher education and lifelong learning than someone from a private school in one of our richer suburbs. That should not be the case, and I think we should change.
I think there's a lot to unpack there, Martin, but if you'll indulge me in a response, I'll first with an anecdote, which is my father was a probation officer's son from Essex who passed his 11 plus and was first in family in university, and I think a not dissimilar story about the path that he took, being radically different to the options that were available to his siblings and his peers at the time. So I absolutely recognize what you're saying. And one of the things that I've been concerned about is about academic careers and particularly early stage academic careers. And one of the slightly glib things that I say to make a point is that I think an academic career is absolutely fabulous if you're independently wealthy. And I think that is the reality today is that for many, the precariousness of the early stage career really means the only people who can get through that the sort of valley of death part of the career to the in a sense the good bit, the bit with an ongoing contract and with good pay and good superannuation and so on, is the only people who can do that are the ones who have independent means. And I think that's not something that we address. I completely agree with you about the issue for students, but I think we have a staff issue as well.
I couldn't agree more. And I had no idea that you were a fellow Essex man in your roots. Always had you down as a Yorkshireman, but you've elevated yourself in my esteem even further with that. But I completely agree. And I can remember my first time going into English universities from an environment of the fire station and the barbecues at the beach that Essex firemen had, and seeing these corduroy trouser, leather patched jackets of pipe smoking men in junior common rooms, and thinking, what is this world? And while that particular stereotype might have progressed a bit, it hasn't progressed enough. And we need diversity in class, in gender, in race, in all aspects of diverse communities in our academic workforces. And we have huge barriers for people for all walks of life to gain positions in our academic workforce of the future. And we won't be the rich place, rich in its truest sense of being attractive and transformational and being a place that brings about change for good all of the time, unless we have that diversity in both our student populations and our academic workforces and our leadership cohorts of the future. And fully subscribe to your view of the breadth in which change is required.
I think close followers of your work will recognize that your interests are very varied. I've got a couple of your books on my shelf. I've got the New Leadership Agenda and the New Learning Economy. Presumably the next book is doesn't just start the new, and you're branching out, but you've been prolific, right? You've published these two books. I know there's another one on the way. This is the 100th episode of the podcast. We've had events, you know, you've gathered people. It's been really, really impactful. And I also want to pay tribute to the role that Carl Treacher played in developing HeadX with you, because I know both sort of on the mic, but also behind the scenes, it's Carl played a hugely important role in supporting the project and really driving it as well. So I want to acknowledge it's as you have done the team effort. But I wanted to focus on, you know, you've been prolific. What are you most proud of? What are the key things that you've learned in the last couple of years of running HeadX?
I think the pride that comes so far is based upon, I'll use a couple of P's. I feel great pride in the partnerships that have developed. I mean, I finished up 38 years working in the sector, last six as a deputy vice chancellor, with a reasonable network. I knew a lot of people at Griffith. I knew a lot of people at QUT. I'd been to my UA conferences, my IRU meetings, my ATN meetings. I hadn't stayed connected with the UK or made much inroads into the US. But I've always valued partnerships. I'm learning this week around my dad's passing, how there's people that knew him that I had no idea knew him. He was a great networker. He was a great relationship builder. I've really enjoyed the partnerships that I've been able to develop. I now have interviewed most of Australia's vice chancellors. I've interviewed, you know, half a dozen in the UK, presidents in four or five different US universities, lots of CEOs of tech companies, employers. I really value those partnerships. I value my partnership with you, Ants. Really pleased to be working with you and with LEK and with other partners in OES and in Vigo and in Microsoft and in Adobe and all of the corporate partnerships that HeadX has developed. I valued them because they're important commercially to HeadX, but I actually value the relationship with the people more than I do anything else. So the partnerships are one thing that I'm proud of, but the thing that I'm most proud of, if I position it in the long journey of change that I think we're all engaged upon, is the potential, there's my other P, partnerships that now offer potential for what the next 5 years might hold. Because I could pull up stumps on HeadX at the 100th episode, third book, and just say, there we go, the Accord's out, this is what I think of it, give someone else the baton. And I'm sure giving other people the baton is a great sign of leadership that I was encouraged to adopt when I first became a head of school. Judge yourself not by what you achieve, but by what the leader that follows you achieves. But I've not finished yet. I'm not pulling up any stumps. I see great potential with HeadX for those partnerships that have been built, for the momentum for change that has only just started. I think it's only getting faster and more important. And I'm really looking forward to the next 5 years. I can't wait for episode 200. I can't wait for the fourth and the fifth book. I can't wait for HeadX events, not only in Australia this year, but the ones that I'm planning to hold in the UK, in Canada, in Dubai, in New Zealand. I can't wait for the things that happen because of the events and the podcasts rather than just the events themselves. The potential to see new universities to emerge, the potential for new edtech ventures to flourish, the potential for higher education to change for good. I can't wait to see that potential realised.
Martin, I think that's a fabulous place on which we'll draw the conversation to a close. I think everyone will hear your passion. Everyone will hear the complexity with which you understand the higher education system, not just in Australia, but globally. That it's grounded in your experience, in your practice. You know, you talk to us about that early stage in your career, working with much more diverse cohorts of students than you've been used to, and how that was a challenge, and also being put into difficult situations and having to position yourself with authority in spite of the context you're in. I'm really grateful that we've been able to situate this conversation also in terms of your story of being the son of a fireman, from a seafaring coastal people of Essex, and how that intellectual and professional journey has taken you far from home, but clearly has also brought you home, and where you've been able to connect the values by which you live and work to the values that you were brought up in. And I'm also, I'm really pleased that we've been able in this conversation to honor Jackie and to see your origin of your pink shirtedness, and to honor Peter, who I know meant and continues to mean so much to you and is a hero. And I think at that point we'll just say, let's change higher education for good. Let's do it.
Thanks, Ant. It's a real pleasure to talk with you and to share the story of these great people with an audience, and I thank all of that audience for indulging my contributing to that story. Thank you.